You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all over the North American continent, on Pacifica radio stations in America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, over 200 cable systems nationwide on the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome to our program, and a special thanks to Carl Frisch for filling in for me yesterday. Very nice to be back here. Caroline Fredericks is with us. Is it Caroline?
Caroline, yes.
Caroline
Fredrickson.
Caroline Fredrickson, Fredrickson. Yeah, and the president of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, former director of the ACLU in Washington Legislative Office. The website is ACS, as in American Constitution Society, law, acslaw.org. And I particularly want to point that out, Caroline, because you have coming up on April 4th at the UC Irvine a debate on judicial review, which is one of my absolute favorite topics, and one of my favorite authors on this, Larry Kramer, the dean of the Stanford Law School, is going to be engaged in that debate, and people can find that over at your website, as well
That's
as a whole
right.
lot of other cool
That's
stuff.
Right. Well, and I think they'll also enjoy Larry is discussing popular constitutionalism with Erwin Chemerinsky, who I think is probably another one of your favorites. Law professors. He's a great scholar and a real progressive and has a lot of insights into the Constitution and how it should be interpreted. So I recommend our website for a lot of programs. That is going to be a particularly wonderful one.
Yeah, it is. Larry's book, The People Themselves, is a strong indictment of the doctrine of judicial review and the Marbury case that had Thomas Jefferson just hysterical, saying, under this, the Constitution is a thing of wax. Speaking of that thing, to be molded by the judiciary in any form they choose. Speaking of that thing of wax and the judiciary molding it, the Supreme Court today, the third day of oral arguments on Obamacare, and the first day largely procedural, yesterday mostly on the mandate, today on Medicare and on severability. Mm-hmm. I am seeing commentary all over the board, from don't worry, it's so complex, the court, Iskalee even says, I can't read the thing, it's cruel and unusual, to, Jeffrey Toobin saying, we're doomed.
Right.
What's your take on this?
Well, I do think it's rather premature to hazard a guess. I am not one of the doomsayers along with Jeff Toobin. I think, in part because I wasn't surprised by the questions that were asked. In fact, these are the questions that the opponents of the legislation have been raising since the beginning. And they're in the briefs. They're the foundation of their lawsuit. So, I think it shouldn't surprise anyone that was where the conservative justices went with their questioning. I think it would have been a complete surprise and bizarre if they hadn't. So I'm not ready to cast in a towel yet. I think, in some ways, from what I'm hearing, at least initially about the severability arguments today, which is the issue about whether or not if you strike down some part of the law, everything has to go, if it's so fundamentally intertwined that the law can't function without it. And they address the question of whether the law can function without the mandate. And I think that's where they kind of started getting wrapped into the weeds and understanding that this really is a very comprehensive piece of legislation. The mandate is a necessary piece to get the coverage of pre-existing conditions. You can't have an insurance pool if all the most healthy people have withdrawn and decided not to participate, and then the costs are way too high. And the whole point of this legislation is to address both the uninsured but also the skyrocketing costs of health care in this country. And so, I guess cautiously optimistic. There are a lot of issues in play, but I'd certainly have some hope for a positive resolution.
Caroline, I'm curious why yesterday, when the broccoli defense was brought out, and correct me if I'm wrong in my recollection, but it seems like that was Barack Obama's original argument against Hillary Care, which is now Obamacare. But why, when that was brought up by those who want to take down, or by actually, I think it was I forget which justice it was. Was it Scalia or Roberts? Somebody brought it up. Why the government's lawyer didn't say, if I don't buy health care, or if you don't buy health care, it raises my health care costs. Mm-hmm. But if you don't buy broccoli, it doesn't raise my food costs.
Right, right. Well, and I think Justice Kagan went there in her question, I think, you know, recognizing that every American family has $1,000 more in the cost of their health insurance per year, because there are $43 billion of uncompensated costs right now that have to be distributed. If the uninsured aren't paying for their health care, somebody actually has to pay, and that's us. And so you're right that we don't have to eat broccoli, but we do actually have to participate in the health care process. And, you know, I would say that it would be very interesting if somebody could possibly find that person who's never seen a doctor. I guess they were born in the forest, has never actually been to a hospital, has never had an occasion to work with medical professionals in any capacity. That person might have a basis for a challenge. But
well, they're few and far between, and they're dying off. My wife's grandmother, the first time, who was born at home in the late 19th century, the first time she went to see a doctor was in her mid-80s, and it was because she'd collapsed from gallstones. They took out her gallbladder, and she lived to 90-something. And,
oh,
you know, died about a decade ago. But she literally had never seen a doctor in her life until she was, what, 83, 85, something
right.
like that.
Well, I
think there's that generation is like, as I said, dying out.
Yeah. Well, and then think for the vast, vast majority of Americans, we participate in the healthcare process. And we usually, hopefully, have health insurance, and we carry our own costs. But there are people who don't,
right.
Who don't have health insurance and who do get sick. And I think that's what this law means to address. There are free riders on the system. They pass on the cost to the rest of us. Our health insurance costs are going through the roof. And this is a rational effort to try and rein them in.
Yeah. And so there are several issues here on the table. There's severability. In other words, can this law be broken up into pieces and individual pieces of it knocked out? There is the Medicare piece, which I guess is a subset of that argument. There is the individual mandate, which is arguably a subset of that argument. Or vice versa. And then there is the entire thing constitutional or unconstitutional? And then in my mind, there's the larger issue of the Supreme Court. Do they even have the right to decide this?
Right.
You know,
right.
That's where
right.
I'm with Larry Kramer. I'm just, obviously that latter is not going to be debated here. Anything that we should be looking for or any thoughts on what the consequences will be if any changes are made in this law between now and the election? We have just a minute here to go.
Well, I mean, I think the real issue, the fundamental issue at stake, I believe, is the view of our Constitution and whether it's actually a straitjacket and handcuffs for our elected officials and forbids them from actually addressing national problems, really significant national challenges.
Doesn't the General Welfare Clause give them carte blanche, and why hasn't anybody raised that?
Well, you know, there's that element of it.
I mean, FDR used that.
Looking more concretely at the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause,
mm-hmm.
what Congress did may not be what some of us would have favored. Some people had, you know, would have preferred a single-payer plan.
Sure.
But that's not the issue. The issue at stake here is whether Congress can actually act. And it was the issue at stake in a lot of the cases that were brought before the Supreme Court during the New Deal. So appropriate to raise Franklin Roosevelt, but the Social Security Act, the National Labor Relations Act, these were fundamental pieces of legislation where Congress acted to address economic problems, and we're in exactly the same place here.
Yeah, yeah, and in some ways back to the Lochner Court.
Yeah, that's right.
It's amazing.
That's right, unfortunately, it's frightening.
Caroline Fredrickson, acslaw.org. Be sure and check it out if you have any fascination with the law, or you're an American citizen. Caroline, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is not going away. We will we'll keep you up to date on this, and of course the decision will be coming down in a few months in all probability, and that's when the rubber hits the road. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot coming up in our second hour. We're going to be talking about the life without parole for 14-year-olds, another case that was heard by the Supreme Court recently. And we're going to have an interesting discussion. I'm guessing it's going to turn into a debate on that. And in the third hour, I want to get into the new American dream. And what this is all about. But today was I'm going to get into that now, in fact. Today was the final day of arguments before the Supreme Court to determine the constitutionality of Obamacare. Yesterday's bruising interrogation by the five right-wing justices on the high court put the cornerstone of President Obama's health reform law, the individual mandate, in jeopardy. And today, the high court's this is the last day of hearing arguments to determine just how much of that health reform law could or should be struck down if they decide that the individual mandate is unconstitutional. Now, here's the big picture on this. The Supreme Court is on the verge of ripping out more of the threads or more of the, what do you call those ropes on a trampoline, whatever, of our nation's social safety net. This is a social safety net that has allowed a middle class to take hold in America ever since FDR created it with his New Deal in the 1930s. And it has allowed that middle class to thrive, and not only that, generate enormous wealth for our economy. But without access to health insurance, and more importantly, without health care being considered a basic right, because you can have access to health insurance, but do you really have access if you get sick and they cancel you? Without considering health care a basic right, that social safety net is in danger. And without it, the middle class dies. In fact, it already is dying with the median wealth in America. You know, the average income, it's not wealth, it's income. The median income in the United States right now is pegged at below $26,000. You try living on $25,900 and change. I know some of you are, and it's damn hard. You know it. I know it. With 49 million Americans living in poverty, 46 million Americans depending on food stamps, 53 million Americans without health insurance, and they're never going to be able to get it if this Supreme Court strikes down Obamacare. Or the 100 million Americans with health insurance who will once again have to live in fear that their insurance company will drop them as soon as they get sick, which is the way it is right now and will be for another 2 years. Or the 17 million children with pre-existing conditions whose only chance to receive the care that they need also depends on Obamacare being upheld. This isn't just about health care. This is about the middle class, which is not real high on the list of important considerations for Scalia or John Roberts or Alito. It wasn't one of Rehnquist's before he croaked. And as more and more Americans fall out of the ranks of the middle class and into the working poor, what they're doing basically is resigning themselves to the fact that their life isn't going to get any better. The old American dream is dead for them. Their only hope now? Cha-ching! Hit the jackpot! Yes, that's the new American dream. It's the lottery culture in America. Meet the face of the new American dream. Chris Shaw, for example, a guy who won $250 million a few years back in a Powerball lottery. He's missing his three front teeth. He says, what are you going to do with your money? Well, I'm going to get my teeth fixed. Couldn't afford to get any dental care up till now. Right. That's the new American dream. Win the lottery so you can fix your teeth. According to USA Today, lottery sales were up last year. A study done by Cornell University found, quote, "We see that lottery sales go up as the economy gets bad, but we don't see people spending more on relatively inexpensive other forms of entertainment," end quote. In other words, people don't view lotteries as entertainment. They view the lottery as a last gasp hope that they can pay off their damn credit card bill. They're getting desperate. You know, it used to be in this country from the 1930s until the 1980s that the number one priority of our government was having a middle class. One good union job working in a factory was enough to sustain a family of four, in my case, a family of six, in a middle class home. You could afford health care, you could afford a car, you could afford education, you could afford a vacation, you could afford a retirement. I mean, this worked for my dad, mom, and me and my three brothers. That's not the case anymore. Now people depend on the lottery to try to get those things. And that's why as the economy gets worse, lotto sales go up. But winning a lottery is just as empty, frankly. There was a fascinating study done by Northwestern University. They looked at a pretty much matched group of lottery winners and car accident victims who became paraplegic or quadriplegic. And what they found was day-to-day pleasures, you know, quality of life. How are you happy? Quadriplegics were doing better than lottery winners. I'm not making this up. Quadriplegics also had more positive outlooks for the future than lottery winners. Interesting note, quadriplegics have a strong social safety net and social security that helps them get by and maintain happiness. This Friday, the Mega Million jackpot is going to hit $476 million. Actually, it's at that now. It may top a half a billion by the end of the day Friday. Largest ever jackpot in the history of the world. Tens of millions of Americans are running out right now to buy tickets, hoping that they might win the new post-Reagan American dream. A dream of safety and security that used to be available to just about anyone who wanted to work. But since Reaganomics has ripped apart the middle class, the American dream has become the American nightmare. Now it's called the European dream. And one piece of that is having access to health care, and the Supreme Court of the United States is standing there, sitting there, actually. Kings and queens of America in their black robes saying, we're going to deliver the death blow to this. We're going to kill it off. Or we have the power to. I frankly don't even think that they should have the power to. I agree with Larry Kramer, the dean of the Stanford Law School, who wrote an entire book on this called The People Themselves, in which he argues that the founders did not intend for the Supreme Court to have judicial review to strike down laws. And they are doing it unconstitutionally. How's that for an irony? Back with your calls after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So your thoughts on health care, on the Supreme Court, on a judicial review, on the news of the day. There's a few other things that I think are pretty important. George Zimmerman is still around. We'll talk about that.
We lost everything.
What do we do now?
Well, seems like our only hope is the lottery.
But
given that the Republicans are the party of fear, let me tell you how this would have played out if the president of the United States was a Republican and not a Democrat. If Richard Nixon, who proposed what we call Obamacare, if his proposal had succeeded, or if Mitt Romney were president and what, you know, Romney Care, which is Obamacare, if his proposal had succeeded, if there was a Republican in the White House right now, and frankly, I don't know why the Democrats don't make this argument, because while by and large, most Democrats figure, hey, we're pretty safe. We're doing okay. Most Republicans are just terrified little people. I mean, they're constantly looking over their shoulder. They have this entire huge machine in Fox News and all the right-wing talk radio telling them,
be afraid, be a very, very afraid.
Constantly. Right? I mean, that's the message. Constantly.
Be afraid. Look out. There's a black guy in a hoodie.
Etc. So if a Republican was in office right now, here's the argument that they would be making on behalf of Romney Care or Nixon Care. And again, I don't know why the administration, or maybe they have made this argument and it just never made the press. Certainly Fox News wouldn't report on it, right? But you would think the others would. It's a national security issue. Remember when George W. Bush wanted us to go bomb Saddam Hussein in Iraq, even though he had nothing to do with 9/11 at all whatsoever, period, end of sentence. There was one guy from Al-Qaeda who was alleged to have spent a weekend in Iraq back 10 years ago, 15 years ago. That's as close as it got because, Saddam Hussein was a Sunni and Al-Qaeda was a Sunni, and they were like different factions. They hated each other's guts. If you showed up at Iraq and said, when Saddam Hussein was president, before we started bombing them, if you showed up and said, hi, I'm with Al-Qaeda, bang, you're dead. So that wasn't our rationale. We weren't looking for bin Laden. We weren't looking for even Al-Qaeda. We weren't looking for the perpetrators of 9/11. No. We were going after Iraq because Saddam Hussein had the capability of making biological weapons. Remember those portable biological factories that the Secretary of State and others actually said were out there. These trucks, they had all those diagrams in there. This is where they boil. This is where they cook the, or not cook, ferment or grow the anthrax germs and all these other things. It's a public health issue. If Saddam Hussein actually did have the ability to inflict a killer flu on us or a killer smallpox on us or a killer anthrax on us or a killer fill-in-the-blank, a new coronavirus like SARS, you want everyone in the country to have access to health care immediately, because the person who's standing next to you at the, you know, at the bus stop or in line at the airport who's coughing might be coughing because they don't have access to health care. And now you need it. It's a national security issue. I don't get it. Zach in Chicago, listening to WCPT. It says you disagree with me here, so you go right to the front of the line. What's up, Zach?
Yes. Hey, Tom. Here's what I think. I think that 4 years from now, we're all going to be talking about the exact same things we are today, and I'll tell you why. I mean, Obamacare, yeah, it's a decent idea. It's pitched as a program to help the poor.
It's not pitched as a program to help the poor. It's pitched as a program to help everybody.
Yes,
rich people can
everybody.
Get sick because the guy walking by them has TB also.
Yes. But
In fact, helping the poor had very, very little to do with Obamacare. That program was put into place by Lyndon Johnson. It's called Medicaid.
Yeah, I understand that. But see, the reason why health care costs are up is because, A, the providers are charging more and more money every year, and B, but that includes both hospitals, doctors, labs.
Actually, provider care costs in many cases have gone down because they're getting the squeeze. Talk to any doctor. I challenge you. Talk to any physician. They're making less money now than they were 10 years ago. The costs are going up. The health insurance companies are charging more because their CEOs are making more. Their stockholders are making more. The companies that manufacture the corporate jets for them with the gold-plated faucets in the bathrooms are making more money. But most importantly, every American is spending $1,000 a year in their health care premiums to pay for the cost of people who show up in emergency rooms without health insurance. And for other people, you know, basically for the fact that we've got 50 million uninsured people, that's costing every single one of us $1,000 a year. And back when healthcare was less expensive, that only cost all of us $50 or $60 a year. And that's the biggest thing.
I tend to disagree with you there, Tom. I think
you can disagree all you want. It's facts. I mean, nobody's disputing this. This is from the Congressional Budget Office. The Republicans and Democrats both make the same point. This was the point the Heritage Foundation made 5 years ago when Obamacare was their idea, when it was the right-wing idea.
I think what Obamacare is going to do is it's just going to keep driving prices up. I just think...
You're wrong. You know, you can think that all you want, but, yeah, I would suggest that you talk to somebody who's actually an expert in healthcare policy. Cheryl, listening on AM 1090 in Seattle, but you're in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Cheryl, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wondered what you thought. I watched listened to the hearings, and the Paul Clement, the attorney, was quoted in Denny Westnett's column. I enjoy his. Anyway, he proposes that we subsidize the insurance companies for insurance for everybody, and then everyone would pay a tax on it, like Denny said in his article. Good news, but we'll be free, but we'll be broke. What is your opinion of that?
My opinion is that the United States, our government expense, the total amount of our GDP, our annual gross domestic product, total spending in the United States, our total economic activity, our government represents about 21% of that. About half of that is our military. The other 10% is everything else. About half of the everything else is Social Security, Medicare, and things like that. And then another half of that, another 5%, is everything else government does, from roads, bridges, national highways, NASA, you name it, right? So there's a lot jammed into that 21%. And Canada, their cost of government is 54%. France's is 58%. Denmark is 58%. Germany is 56%. Most countries, and what that does is it means that the corporate sector is actually a smaller part of the economy than the government sector. And the result of that is that when the corporate sector faints, like they did in 2008, when they crash, it doesn't hurt the economy as badly. The economy is far more resilient. And when people are out of work, they don't lose their health care in all those countries because the health care is part of the government program. So
that's what's happening in our state here. Now, he said that Washington, which is one of the more liberal states as far as medical, is already $1 billion in the hole in the hospitals, or $2 billion. I mean, this is just only going to increase. How can they support the thought that people are going to be better off if the insurance companies get richer?
I don't know how they can. I mean, a couple of the things that Obamacare does that are really, really important. Number one, by making sure that everybody in the country has available to them early detection programs, that women can get mammograms, men can get prostate exams, everybody can get their blood pressure checked and their triglycerides and all that other stuff. I don't know what the whole list is. It's been a year since I had a physical, but you know what I'm talking about, where they catch diseases early. If people started doing that, you'd have a lot fewer late diagnoses, which are very, very expensive. So what happens is that over the, it'll take 4 or 5 years for it to actually take effect. But we would end up like other countries where you have fewer people with late stage diseases and a lot of cures in the early stage. That reduces the cost of health care, number one. Number two, they've mandated that the health insurance companies cannot spend more than 15% in the case of the large companies, 20% in the case of small companies on CEO salaries, administration, marketing and advertising, corporate jets, 3 martini lunches, all that kind of stuff, that they have to spend 85% for the big companies and 80% for the small companies on actually healing people, right? Actually paying for health care. Now, Medicare pays 97% of all the money that goes through them to heal people. Same with Medicaid. The Veterans Administration is 98%. So, socialized medicine, the Veterans Administration, single-payer health care, Medicare and Medicaid are actually far more efficient. But still, they're going to take it from, 65% right now of the health insurance companies, 65 to 70% of the dollars that they get, do they spend on healthcare? They're pushing that up to 80%. So that's going to cut costs. That's, so there's a whole variety of ways that Obamacare is going to be better for the country economically. And the Republicans, it's so bizarre to hear these guys on the right screaming about this. Rush Limbaugh saying, the liberals on the Supreme Court don't like this because they don't like like Obamacare because they don't like the Constitution. What nonsense. I mean, just 6-8 years ago when the Heritage Foundation was out there pushing an individual mandate and the program that we call Obamacare, all the conservatives were all over it. I mean, just, use the Google machine. I don't get it. It's just amazing. Cheryl, thank you for the call. John in Fresno. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a suggestion that relates indirectly to the medical issue, more directly to the Supreme Court, and directly to the Democrats' kind of terminal case of wimpiness. It's a simple fact that in politics, attacks work. They work to weaken the Clinton administration with the impeachment of Clinton. I think the Democrats should start a campaign to impeach both Alito and Roberts on the basis that they have committed perjury in public.
Yeah, during their confirmation hearings, yes. And exactly. They should throw in Scalia for violating the Federal Judicial Code of Ethics by taking Dick Cheney duck hunting 2 weeks before he ruled on a case in which Dick Cheney was the defendant. And by the way, Dick Cheney won that case with Scalia's vote. I'm totally with you, John. Unfortunately, you know the story. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Should we, is it mandatory health care, or is it, we're all taking care of each other? Exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, it's our Higgins alert, my crazy cat. Well, this case is actually a dog. I've had dogs since I was born until about 10 years ago when our last and I think oldest, 20 years old dog, or nearly 20 dog, Sabra died. Anyway, this dog learned a new trick. George, a 2-year-old Basset Hound from England, somehow managed to dial 999, which in the United Kingdom is the same as dialing 911 here, after becoming entangled in a phone cord when his owners were out of the house. Concerned by the sound of heavy breathing that they thought was a human, the 911 operator immediately dispatched a police officer to George's home. Policemen entered the home and, with the help of a neighbor, quickly untangled the poor pooch. Speaking to a local newspaper, the policeman said, I knew I had to get him free quickly, so I just ripped the wire out. Incredibly, you could see where the paw print was on the phone to ring 999. He literally saved his own life. Rumor has it George is starting a how to dial 911 class for his canine pals, and Mitt Romney's dog was the first to sign up. Yeah, there you go. Oh, my. Doc in Jersey City, New Jersey, listening on WWRL. Hey, Doc, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call. Tom, I want to comment on this individual mandate. I mean, we should be reminded that what this thing does is it tells Tom Hartman and myself and everybody else that we have to pay health insurance companies and their CEOs and their shareholders, instead of what they really should have done in the beginning, was to give us a single-payer system. So if they knock this down, it might be an opportunity to send this back to Congress, which I don't think they're going to probably do anything right like they should have done in the beginning, but they sold us out before they even got started.
Yeah, well, we'll
and
see.
I really find that offensive. I also find offensive that I have to pay any health insurance company who are making money on people's sufferings.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Doc, in principle, and I would love to see a single-payer system, and thank you for the call. And that's basically what Dennis Kucinich said on this program. Kucinich.us, by the way, for more information about Dennis and what he's up to, was that if the Supreme Court knocks this thing down, it will open, and particularly if the Democrats take the House, the Senate, and the White House in the next elections, which is a huge if, given the amount of money that the Koch brothers and others are pouring into the campaigns. But if that happens, it will provide a large opening for a big debate on single-payer health care. And frankly, they don't even need to do it at the federal level. All they need to do is say it is legal for any state to create its own single-payer health care system. And you will have what Tommy Thompson did in Saskatchewan someplace. It'll start probably in Vermont, and it will spread across the country like wildfire. It won't even be a generation. It'll be a matter of 5 or 10 years at the most. So, you know, hopefully. Pete in Roselle, Illinois. Hey, Pete, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hi. Hey, good afternoon. My point is I've been hearing the sophomoric replies about the mandate that if we're forced to buy health insurance, why aren't we forced to buy a car or a cell phone, whatever?
Right.
Well, those are obviously silly remarks. But
well, actually, here's the simple answer to all of those things. The fact that I don't buy health insurance and you do, and I get in a car accident or I get sick and I show up at the emergency room means that you're having to pay $1,000 a year extra in your health insurance. Now, on the other hand, if you buy a car and I don't, it doesn't raise the cost of your car. If you buy car insurance and I don't, it doesn't raise the cost of your car insurance, assuming that I don't have a car or car insurance, and since we're mandated.
Right.
So, you know, it's just a false equivalence.
The whole idea is that about the mandate, that you're being forced to buy something.
Yeah.
Well, eventually you're going to be forced to buy health insurance. So why not? 26 seems to be some magic number. You can stay on your parents' health insurance until you're 26.
Right.
So why don't we start there? At the age of 26, you're going to be mandated to buy insurance, and you pay X amount. But if you wait until you're 35, until you get sick or you think you're sick and you finally go to a doctor, well, from then on, you're going to pay more than the other person.
Right.
So you're not being forced to pay right away, but if you want to wait, fine, but it's going to cost you a lot more at that point.
Yeah. Here's clip number 5, Jacob. Here's Mitt Romney addressing that on the Jay Leno show the other night.
What about pre-existing conditions? And
yeah.
Children, that's the thing. I mean, I know people who could not get insurance up until this Obamacare, and now they're covered. Their pre-existing condition is covered.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, to me, that... And children also. It seems like children and people with pre-existing conditions should be covered.
Yeah. Well, people with pre-existing conditions, as long as they've been insured before, they're going to be able to continue to have insurance.
Well, suppose they were never insured
before.
If they're
45 years old and they show up and they say, I want insurance because I've got a heart disease, it's like, hey, guys, we can't play the game like that. You've got to get insurance when you're well. And so you look at the circumstances that exist. But people who've done their best to get insured are going to be able to be covered. But you don't want everyone saying, I'm going to sit back until I get sick. And then go buy insurance. That doesn't make sense.
No, if they do that, you should just tell them, die, die, die. Jay in Colonial Beach, Virginia. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, brother man, how you doing?
Good.
I called yesterday, but I didn't realize how long I'd be on hold, so I called back today.
That's quite all right. Carl did a great job. He had a lot of guests, though, so he probably didn't take a lot of calls.
Yeah, I don't mean to start off insulting, but I'm not sure why you and Carl and everyone else is so damn obtuse. We right now have the Supreme Court trying to decide whether or not Americans should be forced to give money to the fifth largest and most corrupt industry in this country.
Right.
Why didn't you skip that fact? When you break your leg, you don't go to the insurance agent. If you have to stay overnight somewhere in the hospital, it's not at your insurance agent's house. It's at the hospital.
Yes, and that's because of a mandate that was signed into law by Ronald Reagan in 1986.
Let me finish. So if you break your leg, you went to the hospital. If you stayed overnight, you stayed at the hospital.
Right.
They did all the work. They did all the paperwork.
Right.
Why should we send that paperwork to some other company to be shuffled to quadruple the price of that medical?
Right.
When all you really
the fifth largest industry
in
America is the health insurance industry. Let's get rid of them. Is that what you're saying?
They're already in session. Why doesn't the Supreme Court mandate that you pay 5%? Everybody, George Bush, Warren Buffett, everybody pays 5% of their paycheck immediately to the hospital.
Yeah, because the Constitution doesn't give them the power to do that. It does give Congress the power to do that. The Supreme Court does not have the power to make law, although they have.
Yeah, okay. But, well, okay, then why doesn't, and we all know the answer because they're owned by the corporations, but why hasn't Congress come up and said, if we're going to mandate that you give your money to somebody for health insurance, why don't you give it to the hospital? That's where you got your health coverage.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
The problem is the hospitals don't run risk pools. So if you get $1 million illness and I get $1,000 illness, that may wipe you out and not wipe me out, and that's not fair. So if we both pay a small amount of money over a long period of time into Medicare or into a health insurance company, you know, but I find myself in a very weird position here. I'm not one to defend for-profit health insurance, so I'm with you, Jay.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
One of the other cases that the Supreme Court, we've been talking about the Supreme Court and health care, but one of the other, Obamacare and all that, one of the other cases that the Supreme Court has recently heard and will be ruling on presumably in June is whether a legislature has the power to basically usurp the judiciary branch of government to say to judges, if somebody's 14 years old, and they're convicted of first-degree murder, you have to give them life in prison without parole. I think this is frankly wrong, not only because 14-year-olds are, they're not old enough to drive, they're not old enough to drink, they're not old enough to vote, they're kids. Their brains are only half-developed. I mean, final brain development happens around 22. But in addition to that, I don't think that the executive branch should be stepping on the toes of the judiciary. I mean, there's a constitutional issue here, too. Colley Stimson is with us, a senior fellow with the HF Center, the Heritage Foundation, Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, heritage.org is the website. Colley, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, glad to have you with us.
Sure.
Justice Ginsburg described these 14-year-olds who have literally life sentences, no possibility of parole, as throwaway persons. This seems wrong to me. I mean, the morality of it seems wrong, the legality of it seems wrong, and the constitutionality of it seems wrong.
Yeah, well, I respectfully disagree. I was in the court last week when both these cases, one out of Alabama, one out of Arkansas, were before the court. And as you know, the technical issue before the court is limited to these two particular defendants, and the question is whether the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual clause bans life without parole sentences for teen murderers. And, of course, the court has already moved in the direction of finding yes in previous cases. Roper said you can't put teens to death.
Actually, you could argue that they voted in the direction of saying no.
Well,
as you just pointed out, they've said you can't put teens to death.
I'm going with you a little bit there, but I mean, I think a lot. Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative and those representing the teenagers feel confident, I think, that they're going to get a favorable ruling. I'm not so confident because in the decision just a few years ago, the Graham decision, where it was found that a person who committed a non-homicide who was sentenced to life without parole, this is a guy from Florida, that was unconstitutional, but they distinguished that case from people who committed homicides. And so,
but one of these two kids was a 14-year-old. The 16-year-old who was with him was the trigger man.
Right.
And the 16-year-old actually committed the murder. The 16-year-old had a good enough lawyer, apparently, that he plea bargained. And part of his plea bargain was
fast enough lawyer.
Yeah. And his plea bargain was to flip on the 14-year-old. So the 14-year-old ended up with life in prison without parole. And he wasn't even the guy who committed the murder.
Yeah.
So tell me this is right. This, tell me this doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment's protection against, you know, cruel and unusual punishment?
The 14-year-old teenager you're talking about, when they entered the store, said it's go time. We ain't kidding. It was part of this conspiracy to not
go
to this
store. So words now are worthy of a life in prison without parole.
No, but what 29 state legislatures have said in this context is that if you're convicted of capital murder, first-degree intentional murder, and you're a teenager, and, of course, you can't get the death penalty, the state can give you a maximum punishment of life without parole, and the state Supreme Courts have all upheld that, and the appellate courts below the Supreme Court have all upheld the constitutionality of that. And so the precedent is on the side of the states being allowed to do that.
But there are some cases, and I thought this was one of them, this 14-year-old, where this wasn't the state can give you.
Mm-hmm.
It was the state must give you.
Right. You're right. You're right.
And that, to me, seems like legislative overreach into the realm of the judiciary. The Sixth Amendment and the Seventh Amendments promise you the right to make bail and a speedy trial before a jury of your peers. And those seem to me in violation as much as the Eighth Amendment. And frankly, the entire spirit of the Constitution, which places basically boxes around each one of the three branches of government. The president can't make laws. He can only sign them or veto them. The legislative branch can't determine the constitutionality of a law or can't, adjudicate cases. That's the judiciary. The judiciary can't declare war on somebody. I mean, each one has their own responsibilities. How is it that the legislative branch can say to the judiciary branch, we're going to bind your hands behind your back and force you to give this 14-year-old life in prison, even if you as a judge or a jury don't want to do it?
Two points. One is that it's the legislature's job to set punishments for various crimes, including if they decide to allow teenagers to be tried as adults. Not all states authorize this punishment for teen murderers. That's point number one. And secondly, not all states are mandatory LWOP states, and there's discretion built systemically into the system in each of these states along the way, so that you find that the majority of teens who kill and do violent things end up in juvenile court, which I think is where the majority of them belong to begin with, having been a defense attorney and a prosecutor. But some states, as you point out, allow only one sentence if somebody's convicted of capital murder as a teenager, and that is LWOP. And
right. Isn't this life without parole? Right.
Right.
Isn't this sort of a variation on the Rockefeller drug laws that then became the Nixon war on drugs that, kind of went everywhere? And that is the legislature determining, and particularly with things like the bizarre things like, crack cocaine, different penalties than for powder cocaine. Crack cocaine principally used in communities of color, powder cocaine principally used by white guys on Wall Street. Isn't this a case of legislative excess? I mean, it may be that the Constitution, although I don't, I've read the Constitution many times. I've never seen anywhere in there where it says that a legislature can impose a penalty that must be followed by the judiciary.
Well, I wouldn't say that in the Constitution, but the legislator's job, among other things, is to pass laws, including
and define the
laws.
Penalties associated with them.
Right,
I understand
right. But look.
But this is not defining the penalties associated with them.
There's a huge difference, Tom. We had this discussion last time I was on your show. You wouldn't remember me because you've had thousands of guests over the years. But the discussion we had last time differentiated between what makes good sense policy-wise and what is constitutional. And
well, I think this is bad both.
Well, I know you do, and I just respectfully disagree that it's within the province of state legislatures to pass laws and include teen murderers with a maximum possible penalty of LWOP or not. And you can go to your legislature and try to change that law. In fact, several states have. Texas, for example. One would think Texas is a hang'em high state in this area. Actually, they've cabined teen murderers who are convicted of capital offenses to just 16 and 17-year-olds. Those below must go to juvenile court and must get lower sentences. So various states have rolled back these provisions. California's been trying for a few years, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, et cetera. So
I understand Cully. We're talking Cully Stimson, Heritage.org, the Heritage Foundation. I understand the problem of, you know, like get with gang violence, and the gang says, okay, who's the 14-year-old here,
right,
or the 13-year-old? Okay, you're the trigger man,
yep,
because you're the one who can't go to jail.
Big problem.
Yeah, it is a big problem. I'm just, and I'm not opposed to doing something about that. I'm just saying that...
Well, especially the person who orders the team to do it.
Of course.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the level, the place where something needs to be done about that, once the ring fence is defined, right? I mean, you know, once the offense is defined in that statute, and,
yep,
and I would argue that all of them have been for a long, long time, it should be with the judge and the jury, and they should be able to decide a case on its merits looking at the person in front of them. And once a legislature says, if this law is broken, this penalty must be imposed, you've stripped the judiciary of their discretion.
And that seems to be where Kennedy was going in his question. Shouldn't judges or something factor in the teen age instead of this automatic mandatory?
Right, or other mitigating circumstances. That's one of many. Yeah. So we'll see how this breaks out. Cully Stimson, Heritage.org, the Heritage Foundation. Cully, thank you for dropping by.
Thanks a lot.
Good talking with you.
Yep.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Should 14-year-olds go to prison forever? Literally forever? I mean, for the rest of their natural lives? No possibility of parole?
Can I get locked up? They won't let me out. They won't let me out. Locked up. They won't let me out. No.
Talk Media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Harold in Kansas City, Kansas. Hey, Harold, what's up?
Hello.
You're on the air, sir.
Yeah, when you was talking to the legal person from the Heritage,
mm-hmm,
you gave an example of two teenagers, a 16 and a 15-year-old. And
16 and a 14-year-old, yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah, well, I wish that you was asking the racial makeup of the...
They were both black.
Yes. Okay. And In fact,
over 80% of all the people on death row or who have... actually, I'm not sure the makeup of death row. It may be higher than that. It may be lower than that, but it's in that neighborhood. But over 80% of all the people who have life without parole are also African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just wondering, could that... I don't know, but I was just wondering, could that be... a motivating factor.
Of course it is. We live in a racist society. There's no doubt about it. There's absolutely no doubt about it. We have arguably, you know, I've said many times, we have two criminal justice systems, one for the very rich and one for everybody else. We actually have several. We have one for the very rich. We have one for everybody else who's white. We've got another one for everyone else who's black. And then we've got another one for people who are, you know, just totally wiped out poor, white or black. And there's probably another one for corporations. In fact, there is the corporation. In fact, they've got their own. It's the WTO, and they can go there to litigate things. But your point is well taken, Harold. There is a racial element to this, and it needs to be pointed out. Larry in Rochester, Minnesota. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. See, I just wanted to make a comment on sentencing for 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
The person they killed is dead forever. What's wrong with a 14-year-old dying in prison? Somebody that's 14 is going to change that will kill somebody?
Yeah, there's actually a fairly well-known star whose name I can't remember, who as a teenager was convicted of murder, but not in a state where the mandated life without parole, and in his 20s or 30s got out and completely turned his life around and has become a movie star. I mean, yeah, there are that means he's a wonderful person, but there are a lot of people who've gotten out of prison and done really good things, and they did really bad things before. 14-year-olds are not fully responsible adults. 14-year-olds don't, you know, the cingulate gyrus, the portion of the frontal lobes, the part of the brain that inhibits behavior, that gives us the ability to know right from wrong and then act on that knowledge, that's not even fully developed in a 14-year-old. And you're going to tell me that this person should be in prison for the next 60 years when they may be a useful member of society? And by the way, you're going to tell me that you and I are going to spend $120,000 a year to keep that person in prison? When we could send them to college for $15,000 a year? I mean, it seems to me like we're just wasting human potential here. I disagree with you, Larry. You know, respectfully, but I disagree with you. So, anyhow, Stephen or Stephen?
Yeah, Stephen.
Stefan, okay. And you're in Oregon. What is it, Yakuts?
Yahats. It's a little town on the coast just south of Newport.
Ah, I've not been there. So what's up?
Yeah, and I'm from Michigan originally. We're like twins.
Oh, great.
So the term Obamacare was created by the right, just like saying death tax, first aid tax. Should we use that term?
Last week, the White House officially started using the term.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
And I've been saying for months that they should adopt the term. President Obama should get credit for it. He worked his butt off to get this through. It was a major achievement. Lyndon Johnson wasn't able to do it. Richard Nixon wasn't able to do it. Harry Truman wasn't able to do it. They all tried. Franklin Roosevelt wasn't able to do it. Teddy Roosevelt wasn't able to do it. All of them tried to say that health care should be a right, not a privilege, and to produce national health care, and none of them succeeded. President Obama did, and now you've got five right-wingers on the Supreme Court who are fixing to strike it down in a way that, frankly, the Constitution does not give them the authority to do. Stefan, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Joe in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, thanks. First of all, I think single payer is the way to go, so you understand where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly,
me too.
What's that?
Me too.
Okay, yeah, I know. Really, I've been listening. That's probably where it ends, because I really think from a liberal and civil libertarian point of view, this mandate is a very scary thing. Yes, maybe we like the idea of health care, this type of health care, although I don't. It's basically a subsidy to insurance companies. If this, and this is earth-shattering, it is game-changing as far as what power we're willing to cede to Congress and the federal government. And
not really.
It is. I'm an attorney.
Not really.
Stuff a lot.
In 1986 in the Cobra Law, in the omnibus budget reconciliation bill, Ronald Reagan signed into law. It says that if somebody shows up at a hospital, we all have to pay with our taxes for their health, for their care. Number one. Number two, this mandate is not really a mandate. If you don't buy health insurance and you don't pay the fine, there is no penalty. There's no penalty. They can't come after you. The IRS can't garnish your house. They can't take it out of your pay. They can't do anything. There is no penalty.
You have committed a crime.
No, you haven't. This is not. There's no criminal component
to
Obamacare.
So you're basically saying there is no mandate.
That's correct.
Well, that's not accurate. Not even the government is arguing that.
No, they're not, and they should be, because that's what the law says. I don't have the language in front of me, but I've read it on this program before. There is no enforcement mechanism built into Obamacare.
But Tom, here's the issue. The issue before the court is not what you're saying. The issue before the court is what's in the pleadings, and the government is not arguing what you're saying.
I agree.
And
I think is a mistake.
And, well, that's beside the point, and they screwed up. Here is the risk. We are this close to be able to be giving Congress and the federal government the authority that really is without limit. And
no, they already have that authority. It's under the General Welfare Clause, Joe.
No, they don't. Necessary and proper cancels that out.
Not necessarily cancel it out. It should be up to Congress. And we already had this argument in 1937 or 36 about Social Security.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, the difference between Social Security and Obamacare is that Social Security forced you to buy insurance from the government. Obamacare forces you to buy it from a private company, but it's a force.
Would you do anything, whatever it takes?
Helping you with the Water Cooler Wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Tip of the hat and many thanks to the number of people who called in to say that the last caller who said, I'm a little concerned here that Obamacare is the legislature taking too much power. If they have the power to force you to buy something from a health insurance company, they have the power to do all kinds of things. That caller had called into my friend and colleague's Ed Schultz's show 3 hours ago with the exact same script. I've told you before about these work-from-home schemes that you will see advertised over on right-wing websites and sometimes on Craigslist, where it is, hey, make blog postings, right-wing blog postings over at the New York Times. Or you actually get paid for every blog post you put on, 5 cents, 10 cents, 50 cents, a buck. Depends on the size of the blog. You can make $5 or $10 if you can make your way onto a radio or TV show. So, number one, consider the source. But number two, to the issue, because this is the argument that is being made by right-wingers. So, gee, what a surprise a right-winger calls and makes the argument, whether he's paid or not. Frankly, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, our first guest was from the Heritage Foundation. I'm sure he's getting a paycheck. The point is that is this question of power in the United States. And I find this a particularly bizarre argument coming from right-wingers. Because here you have the Supreme Court, which was never given the power to say that a law is constitutional or unconstitutional. If you can find that in the Constitution and give me a call and point it out to me where it says that the Supreme Court has the right to strike down laws passed by Congress and signed into law by the president, I'll send you a case of books. It ain't there. And there are limits on constitutional power. There are already limits on legislative power. They're called elections. In fact, this is how the founders envisioned we would determine what was constitutional and what wasn't. Was if Congress passes a law that the vast majority of Americans who are competent and capable of reading the Constitution and figuring out what it says, if the vast majority of Americans say, hey, this law is beyond the pale, then they throw the bums out and replace them with a new set of legislators who will remedy the problem. And, you know, this was Jefferson's whole premise, was that you have to trust the people en masse. And he was right. I'm going to get into this in considerably more detail in the next hour. But let me just say, in response to the last caller, our apparently paid, you know, shill for the healthcare industry or for the, you know, or not for the healthcare, probably for Dick Armey or for the Koch brothers or whoever it is that's driving this thing, this anti-Obama, probably for the RNC, actually. Because if Obamacare is knocked down, it'll make Obama seem weak, which will hurt him in the election. If he's upheld, then he gets a great victory, and it'll help him in the election. That's what this boils down to for the partisan Republicans. Let me just say respectfully to my last caller and to people who are making that argument that they have their heads so far up places where the sun doesn't shine that they're not seeing what's actually going on. First of all, if you want to talk about a power grab, the power grab is the Supreme Court saying that they can strike down laws passed by our representatives. We didn't elect the Supreme Court. Who made them kings? The Constitution didn't. This is not just a rhetorical question. The answer to the question is John Marshall in 1803 in Marbury versus Madison. But, and as I said in the first hour when we had the person on from the Constitutional Law Society, in fact, I think I still have that up. Maybe not. No, I don't anymore. Anyway, I was going to. Larry Kramer, the head of the Stanford Law School, is going to be having a debate in a couple of weeks. And you can find the details over at acslaw.org about whether or not the Supreme Court should even have the power to declare something unconstitutional. Okay, number one. So you want a power grab? The power grab's happening with nine men and women in black robes, about 8 blocks from here, from where I'm sitting right now. Secondly, to say Congress has overreached its power, that's not the Supreme Court's job. That's your job and my job, and we exercise that at the polls. So, anyhow, I hope I have made my rant clear. Des in Park Forest, Illinois, listening on Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT. Hey, Des, what's up?
Yes, you're absolutely right when you say that the Republicans want the individual mandate, the whole Obamacare, to be eliminated to make him look weak.
That's
you're right.
Right.
That's the bottom line with the Republicans. But I say that we should have single-payer health care And if you will allow me to tell the truth about this matter, at the beginning of the administration, they could have gotten single-payer health care. But Mr. Obama went and made deals behind closed doors with the health insurance companies, who call themselves health insurance companies. What they really are is parasites.
They are, but let me interrupt you, Dee. He cut this. The deal that he made with them was, I'm going to do something that's in the best interest of the American people. You guys are no longer going to be able to take $4 out of every 10 that is given you by your patient, by your clients, and put it in your pockets. You're only going to be able to take $2 out of every 10. Your medical loss ratio is going to have to be 80%. And in exchange for that, in exchange for that pain that I'm going to inflict on you, I'm going to give you 30 million new customers. And so at the end of the day, you'll be just as profitable as you are now. That was the deal he made. And the reason he made that deal was because he had Democrats in the U.S. Senate like Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu and Blanche Lincoln and independent Joe Lieberman, who he knew would not go along with single-payer health care. He did not have that in the pocket, like you're saying, Dee. I know that's a great Republican talking point. Obama had Congress. No, he didn't.
Okay. Why did he just go to the American people and let them know? Because, look, when you have cancer in your body, you have to kill it, or else it's going to kill you, or a parasite will attach itself to the host and drain the host dry. That's what the so-called health insurance companies are going to do, continue to do.
Well, we'll see, Dee. I got your point, and I've got a lot of other callers who want to get in here. One of the things that is in Obamacare is that in 2017 and maybe in 2014 with a waiver, individual states will be able to do what Saskatchewan did back in the 50s and say, we're going to do a single-payer health care system. Vermont has already passed the enabling legislation. It's already been signed into law by their governor, and they are right now working out the details of it in health care committee so they can hit the ground running as soon as it's legal. So the days of the health insurance leeches, as you described them so correctly, Dee, those days are numbered. They are definitely numbered. Ryan, in Acadia, California. Hey, Ryan. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been a long-time fan of yours. I've watched or listened to your show for a long time.
Thank you.
I'm also a physician, and I wanted to agree with you on the point about physicians' reimbursement. My reimbursement rates over the last 10 years have certainly gone down significantly.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm calling, actually, is I received one of those pass-it-along emails. It was about a proposal that Warren Buffett had put out where he could fix Congress, and it was called the Congressional Reform Act of 2012. I haven't heard you speak on it, and I was wondering if you had heard about it and spoken on it when I was...
You're talking about the one that says that, you know, term limits, or they can't get more pay if they don't do so-and-so and blah-de-blah-de-blah.
Yes.
Yeah. Warren Buffett had nothing to do with that. That was something that's it's completely invented. It's got a bunch of really, really bad policy things in it, like term limits, which will simply cement the power of lobbyists forever. If you have term limits, that means the lobbyists have really won. They've taken over Congress. Because if everybody coming into Congress doesn't know how things work and doesn't know how things work in this city and where the levers of power are and how to get things done, then the only people who are the institutions, who always are here, who always stay in place, are the lobbyists. That is it's a phony letter. It was never proposed by Warren Buffett, and you know, don't believe it. And it's promoting bad policies. Ryan, thank you for the call. Bob in Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bob, got a minute to the break. What's up, Bob? No, Bob. Okay. Ann in Santa Clara, California. A little less than a minute to the break. Ann.
Hi, Diane.
Oh, Diane.
Hi.
My apologies.
I love your show, Tom. But I wanted to tell you, I feel like people are ready to crucify Zimmerman, and I thought I was a progressive, you know. But 1% of the time, I listen to Fox News just to see what the other side is saying. And I wanted to say, for the first time, Bernie Goldberg said something that really kind of got me, which I've been thinking about. You know, in Detroit, he was saying, I hate the Fox News, but saying, and it's true, that violent things happen. Like there was a baby, 9 months old, who was...
Yeah. Ann, I'm sorry. Thank you for the call, but we don't have time for a long story. We'll be right
back.
You're
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if it was said on Fox News, my first instinct is to not believe it. We'll be right back.
Come on in. I've got to tell you what a state I'm.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and our Talk Radio News is brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, Nine Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st Century by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman, available in bookstores near you and on all the usual sources online. And speaking of Ellen Ratner, she's on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, where are you today?
Well, actually, I just got to Washington, but
I've been
with our news people all day, so I don't need to talk about the health care. I'm sure you've talked about that up the whatever, but I will say this. I got an email from Carl Ginsburg, and I think it's our Carl Ginsburg, from the National Nurses United. And
yes,
what they figured out.
Yeah.
He's probably already been talking about that, so I'll move on.
Well, no, I didn't get that email. I do know Carl, with the National Nurses, and tell me what he said.
Well, he said that 4 out of the 9 justices are already qualified for Medicare, so they don't have an investment in this. And Thomas and Alito will both qualify for Medicare within 2 years.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
I thought that was very interesting. I mean, they don't have this pain and suffering that a lot of people do, and their wives and, you know, their wives and spouses or whatever don't have it either.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, some other news. Yesterday, Speaker Boehner would not really talk about the president and what happened with the incoming President Putin when they were in South Korea. We're not talking about the slip of the tongue. We're talking about their meeting, et cetera.
Right.
Well, today, and he said, you know, I don't believe in criticizing anything while the president's overseas, while the president is back. So now he's criticizing, and he sent a letter to Obama, and he said, I'm alarmed at the message you sent to incoming President Putin in South Korea. And he said the Russian government has not lived up to obligations to support the world community, and he just went on and on. So, yes,
sure.
Yesterday he was Mr. Nicey Nuts, but today he's definitely not.
And the Cold War is back.
It is back.
Or at least the Republicans want it back.
Oh, they sure do. France has announced that they, with the United States, is thinking of a joint oil release from their petroleum reserves, the U.S. from their petroleum reserves, to begin to reduce the price of oil. Very interesting today, Patrick McHenry, he's a Republican from North Carolina, Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut, is now and a Perlmutter of Colorado, a Democrat, are trying to introduce legislation that would prevent job applicants and corporations for people applying for a job to provide passwords to their private Facebook. Apparently a lot of employers want to see what these people are writing before they hire them, and they're insisting that they be given the passwords to somebody's private Facebook.
Wow. And so we're talking about legislation to ban that practice by employers.
To ban that practice.
I
never even knew that existed. I think it's the most outrageous thing I've heard of.
Well, it's another example of what happens when you have a country where unions represent 8% of the private workforce. There is so little worker power in this country that corporations, employers are kings. They're emperors. They feel absolute sense of entitlement. And they view their employees, in many cases, particularly very large corporations, view their employees like ants on an anthill, you know, and just do whatever they want.
Now, this is a killer. Senator Biden Vice President Biden made a speech today in Davenport, Iowa. And he said this, and apparently Rance Priebus, who's chairman of the RNC, didn't deny it. I mean, I don't think he was asked directly on a conference call with reporters, but he basically didn't say that it was wrong. It turns out that Romney outsourced during his tenure as governor, a call center to India from Massachusetts. In other words, I mean, I can just see if I was President Obama, I'd be like, let's make an ad on this and we'll wait till October.
You know, if Biden had done that 20 years ago, that would be at the top of Drudge for the next 3 days.
That's right.
That's
Can
amazing.
You imagine? I bet you doesn't even see much of the light of day.
Did you know that Mitt Romney's house in California, his mansion, his $12 million mansion that he's tearing down on the seacoast there on the beach, so that he can build a brand new mansion that has an elevator for his cars
right.
in it?
He's claiming that elevator is just a way to move cars. Give me a break.
Right, and the elevator for his car. That mansion has its own lobbyist. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
They hired a lobbyist for the mansion, and the lobbyist went on the record yesterday and said, well, a lot of wealthy people hire me as a lobbyist for their mansions because they need to get variances and zoning changes and things, and somebody has to go in and lobby for these things with elected officials and government bureaucrats. And so it just makes perfect sense that, you know, I guess Romney paid him like $40,000-$50,000 to lobby for his mansion. It's a mansion with a lobbyist.
That is unbelievable. I had no idea about that. I'm still smarting of the fact about this call center.
Yeah.
I just can't believe it hasn't made it to top of the whatever.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
Steve LaTourette, a very nice Republican congressman from Ohio, and a Democratic congressman, at least one, are trying to put forth their plan. Of course, the Ryan plan is being debated as we speak in this House. And they want to base their program on the Simpson-Bowles thing, but they want to increase taxes by $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years on a certain group of people. I'm sure it is not the middle class, let me tell you.
Right.
And so there you have a Republican who's not afraid of the tax reform pledge and is willing to do this.
That is great. In fact, the people's budget, I don't know if you're familiar with this, Progressive Democrats of America are pushing this, and a number of elected officials are supporting it. There's a link over at TomHartmann.com, and you can click on it to get to the people's budget. It's really worth checking out. So what else is going on?
Okay, a couple other things. Today, Michael Sheehan was the assistant. He's the Assistant Director of Defense. He said that they are working on PSYOPs. That's psychological operations. He said they want to change Al-Qaeda's narrative. That they have to, in order to do this, they have to have the partnership of the United Arab Emirates, Yemen, and Bahrain, as well as Saudi Arabia. He said also that the heroin trade of the Taliban is making life very, very difficult for them because of just the vast amounts of money that is going on.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann. You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you to the third hour of our program. On Monday of this week, I did a rant about how the Supreme Court was never given the power to overturn laws based on the Constitution. That clip went up over Democratic Underground yesterday, and it was up today, this morning. And there are comments and that I'd like to respond to. The first comment was from Elling, E-L-L-E-N-G, who quoted from Wikipedia, not exactly a reliable source of constitutional information, saying, quote, federal and state courts at all levels, both appellate and trial, are able to review and declare the constitutionality or agreement with the Constitution or lack thereof of legislation that is relevant to any case properly within their jurisdiction. End of quote from Wikipedia. That was the comment about what I had to say. Well, yeah, courts do claim that power. But notice this carefully. None of the people who commented on DU, as of a couple hours ago, I haven't looked at it since I went on the air, actually quoted the Constitution, saying that any court has the right to overturn laws passed by Congress and signed by the President. The reason why nobody said that over DU, it's not in the Constitution. Please read it. The Constitution. The second post was from Marshall, who quoted Nixon saying,
when the president does it, that means it is not illegal.
Well, Nixon did say that. But it wasn't the Supreme Court that overruled him. It was Congress, which passed a whole slew of, well, actually, Congress was fixing to impeach him, and that's why he resigned. He knew that. And then after he resigned, Congress passed a whole slew of campaign finance and transparency laws in the wake of Watergate. That's the appropriate role of Congress, to pass laws. If Marshall meant to imply that the Supreme Court is necessary to stop a rogue president like Nixon, then I'd like to make two points. The first is that the Supreme Court didn't stop Nixon, and under the Constitution, they can't. It's the job of Congress to impeach or remove a president from office. Again, please read the Constitution. Second is even more important. The reason why early conservatives at the Constitutional Convention did not allow the people to vote for U.S. senators or for the president, keep in mind, at the beginning of this country, at the founding of this country, and right up until 1913, senators were appointed by politicians in each state. And the president is, to this day, is elected indirectly by the Electoral College. Only people directly elected are members of the House and Senate, or members of the House of Representatives in the original Constitution. And that was because the conservatives in that day didn't trust we the people with the full reins of government. They also thought that the senators should represent the interests of the rich, like in the British House of Lords, which the Senate was based on, while the House of Representatives, which is directly elected, could represent the interests of the average person, like the House of Commons in the UK. Commons, the commoners. Thomas Jefferson and many of the other founders fought this tooth and nail. They didn't think there should be a ruling aristocracy in America, but that they thought that all decisions should ultimately be made by we the people every 2 years in elections that either kept politicians in office or threw them out because they made bad laws. Jefferson wrote a brilliant and rather long letter to his old friend Samuel Kershaval about this, about the appointment of senators instead of their being elected. He said it was the first, quoting Jefferson, quote, Republican heresy, small r, in this first essay of our revolutionary patriots at forming a constitution, end quote. Jefferson added that because of John Marshall's Marbury decision in 1803 that gave courts the power to strike down laws, remember, it's not in the Constitution, that because of that decision, the courts now had even more power than the executive, the president. He wrote, a faction once possessing themselves of the bench of a county can never be broken up, country can never be broken up, but hold their country in chains, forever indissoluble. Yet these justices are the real executive as well as judiciary. In other words, Marshall, your law is that the people can't be trusted to throw out politicians who pass unconstitutional laws, and therefore we need to have 9 all-wise people on the Supreme Court to decide whether any law will stand or be rejected. That isn't democracy. That's a kingdom with the Supreme Court justices as kings. Do you really want that kind of a country? Remember, you can't vote the Supreme Court out of office. In that same letter, Jefferson talked about how the appointed Senate and Supreme Court would defend the rich, as the Senate did until we amended the Constitution during the Progressive Era, the 1913, so that the people could directly elect our senators. But back in the late 18th, early 19th century, Jefferson wrote that he and the other progressives of his era wanted the people to have the most power. Quoting Jefferson, quote, their object is to secure self-government by the republicanism of our Constitution, as well as by the spirit of the people, and to nourish and perpetuate that spirit. I am not among those who fear the people. They, and not the rich, are our dependents for continued freedom. End of quote. But back to the comments over at DU. Lars 77 said, well, a buck needs to stop somewhere. Plenty of things the founders did not anticipate. In a functioning democracy, the Supreme Court is not corrupt and therefore would be competent to handle things like this. End of quote. Actually, the founders did anticipate this, and they rejected it. Read Madison's notes on the convention, on the Constitutional Convention. The buck for all lawsuits does stop somewhere, the Supreme Court. It's in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. But the buck of what's constitutional? That is not a power given to the Supreme Court. As Jefferson pointed out, that is way too much power for 9 unelected people serving for life to have. The founders of this country did not want us to have kings and queens in America striking down laws passed by the representatives of the people. And that's why they didn't give the Supreme Court that power. Again, read the Constitution. If Congress passes an unconstitutional law, the people will rise up and protest and throw the bums out, and a new Congress will fix it. Or the president actually does have the power under the Constitution to veto a law passed by Congress because he thinks it violates the Constitution. But not the Supreme Court, because they're not answerable to you and me. And this isn't supposed to be a kingdom. Spectator said over at Democratic Underground, it's called balance of power, three co-equal branches in theory. Actually, those phrases never appear in the Constitution. Nothing about balance of power in the Constitution. The first among equals, Article 1. The first of the three branches of government is the legislature. They and only they have the power to tax and spend and create laws. Second among equal, the president, has the job to carry out laws Congress passes and can veto laws he thinks are unconstitutional. And the third among equals, the Supreme Court, is, as the Constitution says, the final court of appeals. So if you and I have a lawsuit that goes from court to court, somebody finally has to have the final say. Again, it's in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 2, which even puts the Supreme Court under the regulation of the first among equals, the Congress. Here's the language from the Constitution that I'm encouraging you to read. Quote, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, right? The final court of appeals. Both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. End of quote from the Constitution. Read it. So I stand with my argument that legal scholars from Thomas Jefferson to the current dean of the Stanford Law School, Larry Kramer, make that the Supreme Court does not have the constitutional power to strike down laws. That power resides with you and me. It's called elections. Again, please read the Constitution. Nowhere in there will you find anything that says that the Supreme Court has the power to strike down laws passed by the House, the Senate, and the President. All, by the way, who are elected and answerable to us, unlike the Supreme Court. This is a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, not a kingdom ruled over by 5 out of 9 people sitting for life on an unelected Supreme Court. The court has been acting illegally for centuries, and Congress should take action to stop it, as Presidents Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin D. Roosevelt tried to do. Wake up. Read the Constitution. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, my rant. And what's so bizarre, I agree with Newt Gingrich and Phyllis Schlafly on this. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, somebody disagrees with me. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. First, I'd like to strongly suggest that you actually read the Constitution. I would like you to read Article 14, Section 3. Now, let me get into my rant.
Okay.
I agree with you about the Supreme Court issue. They don't have the authority. They were never given the authority. But the concept of a Congress...
There is no Article 14.
Pardon?
There's no Article 14. The highest article is Article 7.
Amendment 14, Section 3. I'm sorry. Oh. Amendment 14, Section 3. Anyway.
14th Amendment. All right.
Having said that, you know, the idea that, let's say Congress passes a law saying, oh, that's right, that they've suspended our right to a trial by jury or to know our accusers or what the charges are against us. Maybe we'll call it the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, in every other area of our legal system, if a judge makes a ruling for which he has no standing, it's called a nullity. You can't appeal it. You
right.
can't get it nullified because it's null and void on its face.
Right.
If Congress passes legislation that clearly violates the Constitution, it's a nullity. It was without force, null and void. My question to you, why did I, as a military officer, why does every member of the government, federal, state, and local, take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and yet if Congress chooses to violate the Constitution, which they took an oath to protect and defend, and the president signs it, and this thing goes into law, we now have to wait, you know, until the next election to show them our disapproval and vote them out. I think Amendment 14, Article Section 3, covers that pretty clearly.
I don't see where it does.
Is there nothing but criminals?
what language in the – this is the Let's see, Article Section 14, Article 3.
No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elected or elector of president and vice president or hold any office.
Well, previously having taken an oath as a member of Congress.
To protect and defend the Constitution.
No, no, it says, listen, do you understand the history of the 14th Amendment? It came out of the Civil War. Article 3 of this, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says, if you are a member, here it is in plain English, if you are a member of the Confederate Forces of America and you were a commissioned officer, you cannot serve in the United States Congress. That's what it says.
That's not what it says. I'm reading it right here in front of me. That's not what it says. It's very clear what it says.
It says if, you know, blah, 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 to if you have taken any other oath to support, you know, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, you may not be a member of Congress. They're talking. This was passed in 1868. This was the radical Republicans they were referred to as. Thaddeus Stevens was the principal author of this. The radical Republican. Go back and read the history of them. It's an amazing thing. This was to punish Confederate war officers.
You know, Tom, this is all wonderful. You know, what its intent was, all I'm doing is read. It seems to me like its primary intent was one of the few places in the Constitution where there's actually any teeth.
No, it's well, it is, but it says that. But you have to have taken an oath to another government, in this case the Confederate States of America, that you would help them overthrow the United States of America. So, you know, at the moment, I don't know of any other nations that are officially at war with us that are seeking to overthrow us.
So, if you violate the Constitution, you have not rebelled or engaged in insurrection against it?
No.
I clearly think it defines that way.
Who has?
You can't pass an unconstitutional. Tom, these are nullities. When Congress passes a law,
only if somebody decides they are.
You know what I'd like to know? I'd like to know why it is that, like Aaron Wattata, the sole patriot apparently during the Iraq War, right? Because he says this is unconstitutional law. Unconstitutional law. I won't follow it. My question is, why aren't our admirals? Why aren't our generals? Why aren't the members of the FBI and the CIA and all these organizations? Why aren't they standing up and saying, no, I'm not going to follow that law. I don't recognize the Constitution.
Well, a substantial number of them did. You'll recall
charge in perpetuity.
You'll recall when the Bush administration first started rolling out some of their derring do that a lot of people resigned from their administration. And, you know, many people have resigned from the military. But the fact of the matter is it's a tough world out there, and not having a job is a tough world. And most of these people, you know, if it's the law, they salute it. And they don't represent themselves as constitutional scholars. I get your point, but you can't base it on the 14th Amendment. And the word nullity does not appear anywhere in the Constitution.
It doesn't appear anywhere in legal jurisprudence. It's just an understood word. If a judge
then it has no legal basis. I mean, it may appear in the military court
Tom, you made the argument the other day, really upset me, someone said something silly like, let's say everybody's got to wear blue noses on Sunday. And you said, yeah, the people would probably go into the streets and say that's not okay. But actually, the next election, we could vote them out for saying that they can't, they told us they had to.
That's our system.
I don't recognize legitimacy. You know, Tom, I guess my point is, I've asked for this forever. I think every single time Congress passes legislation, they should be mandated to define exactly where in the Constitution they get the authority to pass that legislation.
Well, then that's going to be very easy. They can simply say it's to promote the general welfare of the nation.
No, that just doesn't work. It's like, you know, what scares me is a few years ago the head of the ACLU was having an argument on a talk show, and the gist of it was he was making the point that the piece of legislation was unconstitutional. I love it. The moderator said, you know, it's not Congress's responsibility to prove that legislation is constitutional. It's your responsibility to prove that it's not. I think we've let this whole nation let Congress turn this on its head.
No.
I think Congress always has an absolute mandatory
right. Arguably that's the case with the Military Commissions Act. But there's nothing in the Constitution that says that Congress has to prove that something is constitutional. The test of constitutionality is defined in the Constitution as the presidential veto. That's it. And the elections. The president, if Congress passes a law that the president considers to be unconstitutional, he can veto that. The executive branch is given the power to veto legislation. If two-thirds of the Congress can overturn his veto, well, you know, if you can get a supermajority, then the majority of the representatives of the people actually think it's constitutional. That's the check and balance right there. But it has nothing to do with the Supreme Court.
Just ask your next 10 callers if they think that that the Congress is corrupted beyond redemption? Just asking that question.
Yeah, well, given the Supreme Court rulings over the last 20 years, the answer is damn near yes, although there are still some good members in Congress. Bill, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with the good, the bad, and the very, very terpsichoreaneously ugly. And your calls. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very terpsichoreaneously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good, LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman. Hoffman recently loaned $1 million to a website that lets people make direct loans to entrepreneurs in impoverished countries. His goal is to get 40,000 people to each lend out $25. The website, Kiva.org, already has nearly 35,000 people signed up, including me, who are loaning out a total of nearly $1 million to entrepreneurs in Kenya, Peru, and more than 50 other countries. Hoffman told the Huffington Post that the best ideas and most successful ventures depend on that initial spark from angel investors. It's nice to see a corporate giant using his personal wealth to help others for a change. The bad, the Eagle Forum. The Eagle Forum, a national ultra-conservative group, is pushing a law in Tennessee that would place limits on the number of foreign-born teachers, even U.S. citizens, that a school could hire. Previously, the Eagle Forum had supported a bill in the state that would have designated some Muslims as terrorists if they were practicing Sharia law. This country already has a shortage of teachers, and if foreign-born teachers can help our students succeed, they can be just as valuable as any qualified American teacher. As for the continued attack on the Muslim community, I'm sure the Tennessee legislature has better things to be worried about than a secret plot by Islam to take over our schools. And the very, very ugly, the Daily Texan. In the newest chapter in the conservative smear campaign against Trayvon Martin, the University of Texas's student newspaper published a racially insensitive political cartoon yesterday. The cartoon features a woman reading to a little girl out of a book entitled Trayvon Martin and the Case of Yellow Journalism. The woman is also shown saying to the girl, "And the big bad white man killed the handsome, sweet, innocent colored boy." End of quote. It's bad enough that Trayvon Martin's death could have been racially motivated, but to continue to promote racial stereotypes and insensitivity in light of it? Now that is very, very ugly. Okay, Tom in Chicago, listening to WCPT, says you're a lawyer, you disagree with me, and you're going to take me apart. Go for it.
No, I didn't say I'd take you apart, Tom. I just said I disagree with you.
Okay.
In a September 11, 1804 letter to Abigail Adams, Jefferson, in fact, supported the idea that the Supreme Court has the power to declare laws unconstitutional.
Oh, and that wasn't the only time. I can give you three or four other examples.
Right, yeah. He wrote to George
Hamilton was on both sides of the issue as well. They were schizophrenic about it during the first couple decades of our republic.
Well, and the reason Jefferson was so against Marbury versus Madison, it was very political.
Yes.
And that's the
right. But he won the case. He won Marbury.
Go ahead, please.
He won Marbury. Marbury versus Madison. You know, do you know the history of the case?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. In fact, I sent you a paper that I just recently completed. I'm hoping to have published in the Journal of Supreme Court History that I'd emailed to you on Monday, and I'm more than happy to email it again.
No, I have it. I have not read it yet.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's been a busy.
Well,
it's been an insane week for me. But I
don't apologize for that. I know that you're very busy and get a lot of emails, so I don't know if you know.
Yeah. Yours got through.
Yeah.
So anyhow, your point.
While there was, you know, no indication in the Constitution, there were, you know, as other people have pointed out, a lot of different things. But the creation of a Supreme Court was unique in regard to world history. The use of courts basically had been part of the administrative arm of the kings on the continent, right. And so this was just a very unique situation, and it was meant to be flexible.
That it would be independent. But there was a lengthy debate in the Constitutional Convention about whether to explicitly put into the Constitution the power of the Supreme Court to strike down laws based on their constitutionality and whether they, quote, comported with the Constitution. And they rejected that. And as Hamilton wrote in Federalist Number 78, and I encourage you to look it up, he said the Supreme Court is the, and he was trying to reassure people because they were afraid that you would have, you know, at that time it was either five or seven, but you would have a handful of unelected, lifetime appointed judges basically deciding the laws of the nation, when in fact the elected, you know, we the people were supposed to decide the laws of the nation. And he said the Supreme Court is the least likely to cause injury. He said it has he said the legislative branch has the power of the purse, the executive branch has the power of the spear. I'm paraphrasing, but it's damn close to his exact language. The judiciary has neither the power of the purse nor the power of the spear, and is therefore the least likely to cause mischief. He said they have no power to enforce their own doctrines, and they are explicitly under the regulation of Congress, as Article 3, Section 2 says.
Hamilton also wrote in 78, and I quote, "No legislative act contrary to the Constitution can be valid."
Sure.
"The interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges
as the highest law,
fundamental law. It is there. It therefore belongs to them to ascertain its meaning."
Yes. Yes. As I said, they were schizophrenic about it. You can find arguments on both sides with both Hamilton, Jefferson, and Madison, for that matter.
No, I agree. But
by 1819, when Jefferson wrote the letter to Spencer Roan that I've quoted so many times, he was out of office. He was no longer president. By that time, there was a growing consensus. It was just 4 years later, after that, when Andrew Jackson was president, when the Supreme Court struck down the right of the state of Georgia to seize Indian lands. And Andrew Jackson said, President Jackson said, John Marshall has made his ruling, let him enforce it. And he ignored the Supreme Court.
Oh, well, of course, because that's kind of the balance and the tension between the three branches. Each must accommodate the other. I know comments have been made shouldn't the gentleman before who was a caller, Congress, determine, say, look, this is constitutional or unconstitutional?
Right. Declare it, you mean? Yeah.
All, pardon?
Declare it. He wanted them to declare it in the law as part of the enabling legislation.
All the branches, I think, historically, are supposed to determine if what they're doing is constitutional or not. The Congress, arguably, if they say, look, you no longer have to abide by, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, slavery's back.
Right.
Can't be done.
Right.
Somebody has to, say, look, you can't do that.
Right, and the somebody is supposed to be us. First three words of the Constitution.
Sure. Yes and no, because we have, in the creation of the Constitution and the country and getting away from the Articles of Confederation, there was a creation of something that was was unique and different. And they did look to separate the powers and look to have, each branch having its own purview.
Right. But the simple fact of the matter is that my quote of Hamilton from Federalist 78, your quote of Hamilton from Federalist 80, I believe it is.
Oh, 78 also.
It's also 78, okay.
Correct.
That notwithstanding, the fact of the matter is that nowhere in the Constitution, and again, go back and read Madison's notes on it, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court has the right or the power to strike down laws as unconstitutional.
I agree, but I think also and after you read my paper, maybe we can continue to.
I would be pleased to. Are you familiar with Larry Kramer's book, The People Themselves?
I am not. I had heard you mention it earlier today.
I strongly encourage you to read it. He's the dean of the Stanford Law School. Brilliant guy. He's not coming out and saying roll back judicial review, but he makes a damn good case for it. And anyhow, I got to move along, Tom.
I
appreciate your call. There's actually two more people who disagree with me. So in addition to 12 other people who want to talk about other topics. So stick around. Keep listening, but thank you very much for your call, and thanks for listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk. Let's see. Adam in Tallahassee, Florida, listening on XM. Hey, Adam, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. Says you disagree with me, too.
Yeah. First of all, let me just say on the outset, I'm a moderate Republican, but I enjoy listening to your program and think you have a lot of well-reasoned arguments on a lot of things.
Thank you.
But in Article 2, well, first of all, the Congress doesn't have the absolute authority to regulate the Supreme Court, and it says in the Constitution that the court has both appellate and original jurisdiction. They have certain original jurisdiction that Congress cannot take away from them on certain types of cases.
That's right, like maritime law and disputes
correct.
Between and among the states and citizens
states,
of one state and another state and over treaties, yes. I mean, those are all laid out in Article 3, Section 1 and Section 2.
It's not entirely subordinate to Congress.
No, I'm not saying it is. What I am saying, however, is that, for example, you'll probably agree with this, that where it says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulations made by Congress, that if Congress was to pass a law that said that the members of the Supreme Court had to comply with the Federal Judicial Code of Conduct, which every other federal judge has to comply with, where they can't have, conflicts of interest. They can't have their wives taking $500,000 from somebody who's litigating a case in front of their court. They'd have to recuse themselves. If Congress passed that law, the Supreme Court would have to follow it. That's what the Constitution says. And what boggles my mind is that the Congress hasn't passed that law.
Well, the text of Article 3, Section 2 uses very, very nebulous terminology. It says that they'll have all judicial power relating to law and Constitution, including Congress.
No, not Constitution.
The United States is a party. It does. I'll read you the text right now. I've got it right in front of me.
Okay.
So this is Article 3, Section 2.
Right.
The judicial power shall extend in all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. And then it goes on to list a bunch of things, including controversies between states.
Right. Arising
in which the United States itself is a party.
Yes. But it doesn't say as to whether those laws comport with the Constitution.
Well, but it has to have the ability to resolve a dispute between the state and the federal government.
So you're making the argument that we should have 9 unelected kings.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Adam, we're
visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, it's going to come down to this. Are we going to have 9 unelected people having final say over all of our laws? Or not. I vote for not.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just to share with you how nonpartisan this is. This is not an issue of Republican or Democratic politics. This is an issue of understanding the history of the United States and what, how the Constitution was constructed and what the debates were at the Constitutional Convention. The third of those Newt Gingrich clips, Jacob. This is Newt Gingrich less than a month or two ago. Here he is.
I'd ask, first of all, have they studied Jefferson, who in 1802 abolished 18 out of 35 federal judges? 18 out of 35 were abolished.
Something that was highly criticized.
Not by anybody in power in 1802. Jefferson himself is asked, is the Supreme Court supreme? And he said, that is absurd. That would be an oligarchy. Lincoln repudiates the Judge Scott decision in his first inaugural address in 1861 and says, no 9 people can make law in this country. That would be the end of our freedom. So I would suggest to you, actually, as a historian, I may understand this better than lawyers. And as lawyers, those two attorneys general are behaving exactly like law schools, which have overly empowered lawyers to think that they can dictate to the rest of us.
There you go. I literally never thought it, Newt Gingrich was my congressman for a lot of years when Louise and I lived in the northern Atlanta suburbs. I never thought I would ever agree with this man. But he's right. Gary in New Leipzig, North Dakota. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Well, I couldn't find my Constitution to look it up, but isn't there a part that says no law shall be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people? And what concept
does
that have?
The Ninth Amendment, yeah. Either the Ninth or Tenth. One is the people, the other is the states. And, in fact, I'll find it and read it for you because it's very, very short. This is why I should wear reading glasses when I'm on the air. Yeah, the Ninth Amendment, the right of the citizens of the United States. Oh no, that's the 19th. Jeez, I definitely need. Hang on just a minute. Here it is. The Ninth Amendment, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And then the Tenth Amendment, the powers not delegated by the United States in the Constitution, nor prohibited to it by the states, are reserved to the states respectively and to the people. Is that what you're talking about?
I wasn't sure how it played out in there. But,
it doesn't.
You know, if it's unconstitutional or illegal, we retain those that aren't.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with issues of constitutionality or the Supreme Court. What that basically says is in the Constitution, there are the Constitution accomplishes two things. Number one, it says here's a bunch of things that the government can't do, right? It can't stop you from expressing your opinion. It can't invade your home without due process and somebody swearing under oath that there's a reason to that a crime's being committed. It can't punish you in a way that's cruel and unusual. So it says a bunch of things that government can't do. It also says specific things that the various three branches of government are supposed to do. Congress is supposed to lay taxes, spend money, pass laws for the general welfare of the people, raise a standing army, but they can only pay for it for 2 years. Really interesting part of Article 1, Section 8. It's the only thing that is... Congress can pass a law to fund Social Security forever, but they can only fund the army for 2 years, a maximum of 2 years, because the founders did not want there to be a standing army during times of peace. But none of that addresses the issue of the constitutionality, Gary. I'm sorry. Thanks a lot for the call. James in Reno, Nevada, you disagree with me. I'm taking my disagree calls first here. What's up, James?
Well, Tom, I listen to your program a lot. I really like your program. And the problem that I have, Tom, two things. One is when you say the murderer, isn't that lynch mob mentality?
Oh, speaking of George Zimmerman?
Yes.
Yes, I didn't refer to him as the murderer. I referred to the death of Trayvon Martin as a murder. And I...
No, you said the murderer. Go back and listen to what you said.
Hang on just a minute. George Zimmerman is still a free man more than a month after he murdered 17-year-old Trayvon Martin
there
in Sanford, Florida.
Murdered.
Okay. Yes, I could have said killed.
Mob mentality?
No, I don't think so. I think it's an assertion of my opinion that was murder. I think when you chase somebody for two blocks with a gun and they're armed with a bag of Skittles and you shoot them in the chest, that's murder.
Well, isn't it also true that it is alleged?
Oh, of course it is. Of course it is. Let me make a very clear distinction here, James. This is not the CBS Evening News. This is an opinion show. You're hearing my opinion. My opinion is it's murder. Okay. Your second disappointment with my show.
All right. If it was a slam dunk.
If what was?
In the Supreme Court that this law is lawful, the health law.
Right.
Would you be saying all the things you're saying now?
Yes, I've been saying these things for well over a decade. There's a chapter in a book I wrote in 1999 called Unequal Protection. It's a book about the history of the United States, starting with the Boston Tea Party, and the history of the doctrine of corporate personhood. And it goes from the Boston Tea Party through the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case in 1886, actually the Dartmouth College case. There's even a chapter in there, and in fact, actually, apropos of your question, there is a chapter in there about the 1803 Marbury versus Madison case. I have been saying for decades, consistently, as a progressive, that the Supreme Court overreached in 1803, that they have been standing on that overreach ever since, that they turned themselves into the kings of America, that no unelected body should ever have the power to strike down laws made by Congress, that power should be reserved to we the people, to you and to me. We should be the ones deciding. And if our legislators are making laws that are not constitutional, we should throw them out on their butts. And frankly, not enough of us are involved to do that. And I think one of the reasons why is because we all think the Supreme Court will take care of it for us, and which makes the situation even worse. So that's my take on it, James. Thank you for the call. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up tomorrow, Arlen Specter is going to be with us. That should be an interesting conversation. Plus, the news of the day and your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Plus, check out the PD America's link on our homepage at tomhartman.com.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.